This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Vi Lyles becomes the city's first female African-American mayor and defies predictions of a squeaker. New faces come to city council due to the election, and the median age drops as a result. Former Governor Pat McCrory lays the blame for his loss last year while leaving the door open for a future run. And following the church shooting in Texas, local churches examine their own safety procedures. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. Tom Bullock is here from the WFAE newsroom. Welcome back.
Thank you.
He's waving at the camera because we're on Facebook Live.
Yes, we are.
Kirsten Garris is a government reporter for Spectrum News. She knows better than to wave at the camera because she's on television. And Oz Helms is education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and contributor to WCCB News Rising. And you can reach us this morning through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. And, of course, the aforementioned Facebook Live.
Bye, bye, you guys are great. Bye, 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 thank you.
That's the sound of the victory celebration on Tuesday night at Vi Lyles campaign headquarters or at the park. And she became the city's first female African-American mayor. I believe, Kirsten, you were at that location on Tuesday night. Were they nervous before these results came in? Because this was supposed to be a 40-40 split.
It was supposed to be, and those supporters were not nervous at all. I got there around 7, and I started asking folks, well, how do you feel? You know, what's the vibe right now? They felt really good. And then as soon as the early voting numbers came in, they were feeling pretty good because at that point, I think Vi was at 64%, and Kenny was at 30-something. So they were feeling pretty good from the start of the night. And when she won, you could feel the sense of, not only did Vi make history, but we made history. We being the supporters, the volunteers, the donors, that whole room said we made history as a whole that night.
So the polls closed at 7:30. When did it become apparent to the people in that room that this was their victory?
7:35. I mean, to be honest, as soon as early voting numbers came in and there was this big gap between, because it was a replay of primary night where, again, Vi had this very big gap ahead of Jennifer Roberts. So as soon as the early numbers came in, they were feeling pretty good. And as we saw, the gap got a little bit smaller because, again, a lot of Republicans usually vote on election day itself. But, I mean, they felt good the entire night. And the only reason why people were sweating because it was just hot in that room. They were not nervous.
And to be clear, too, these early voting numbers that you got, there was, 36,000 people who voted early. It was roughly a third of the overall votes. And the second those first results came out, Vi Lyles was ahead by, 8,400 votes? Significant. And as it went on, I mean, Kirsten's exactly right. Margins shrank a little bit. But realistically, I mean, if you think about it, this was supposed to be a squeaker.
Yeah.
I was planning for an all-nighter. By 9:15, I believe it was, you have concession speech right on top of that almost while it was going on. You have an acceptance speech. This blew everybody away. This was a decisive victory.
And almost every race was like that with the early voting. I wonder if that's just a different dynamic with early voting because very few races changed after that 7:35 or whenever they dropped.
What do you mean by
results?
Different dynamic? Because we've had early voting in the past.
We have, but having been somebody who was sitting there reporting and updating, that sometimes you get person A is in the lead and you write an early version of the story and then more votes come in and person B pulls into the lead.
You did see some switches. I mean, James Smudgy Mitchell is a great example of this. Democrat, at-large member of the city council, obviously running for re-election. When the first numbers came out, he was second. By the end of the night, he lost that. He went into third. He obviously was re-elected, but he went into third as Braxton Winston's numbers jumped. So you did see some movement.
Not that there were zero changes, but not major, not this person's winning. Oh, no, another person actually won.
True.
But when do they count the early votes? Are they counted first? Are they counted last? Are they counted with the other
first votes?
They're counted first.
They post them fairly soon after the polls close.
Yeah, they count them as they come in. And that's the really interesting thing about this, the early tranche of vote counts. In primaries in particular, they are a great poll, almost an ironclad predictor of how the night is going to go. If it's close in those early voting numbers, you know it's a real contest. If it's, somebody leading by a wide margin. I mean, you were talking about the primary, Kirsten, and those early primary numbers. Vi Lyles came out with, a huge lead, and she held that margin against Jennifer Roberts in the primary. General election can be a little bit more tricky because Democrats tend to vote early or more likely to take advantage of early voting. Republicans tend to vote day of. But we didn't even see that. Like, it those margins held.
So you were not here last Friday, Kirsten. Oh, actually, you were. You observed last Friday.
Exactly. I made a guest appearance as an audience member.
And you're not, this is above your pay grade, but the spectrum, the poll that we're talking about here that had the 40-40 split between Vi Lyles and Kenny Smith was a Spectrum News poll. Now, I know your organization doesn't do the poll. They simply commission the poll. Have you fired the pollster?
Yeah. That is above my pay grade. And it was 41-40 to be exact, yep. just to put it out there. But I know.
I think you're splitting hairs there.
Just saying, that's what they did.
I think we know that people are not going to trust polls again. But this was very significant. And, you know, even for roll call, we talked about it because it did have national resonance, even though the national coverage didn't get a lot of the nuance. It's, you know, first African-American woman elected mayor. Well, of course, it was in Charlotte, which is a blue island in the state of North Carolina. And she was against Kenny Smith, who had not won a citywide race. Some of the campaigning got a little harsh when people knew who Vi Lyles was, and she'd been a known quantity. But still, there were these ads, these money coming in. So it did trend a little bit like the national races were going. And you saw overall the vote totals were high because, I mean, Kenny Smith got a lot of votes. But the people really came out for Vi Lyles. And that showed, well, is this going to be a trend? Is there that enthusiasm for Democrats going forward?
So on election night, Vi Lyles talked about the impact of that Spectrum News poll.
I think that poll really gave people a wake-up call because the articles have been saying things like she's got the wind behind her back, and that would mean that people would automatically come out and vote for me, and that poll helped people understand that we had to do more.
Is that what happened? Or did it rally people to get out and vote? Is that what happened as a result of that poll?
It's hard to say. In fairness, Vi Lyles also did a lot of fundraising off of that poll. It's always good for a candidate to have a tight race because, yes, that will motivate your base or may sway some undecideds to jump into the race. But overall, you cannot just credit or blame that one poll for this. I mean, we keep talking about the margins here. We talk about, you know, the percentage that Vi Lyles defeated Kenny Smith with. But the vote totals themselves are also spectacular. Think about Kenny Smith in this. Mm-hmm. He had 49,555 votes. That's huge. You know,
she had 72,000.
She had 71,876, mm-hmm. which you just stole my kicker, so thank you for that. But honestly, if you go back to, you know, 2015 when it was Jennifer Roberts against Edwin Peacock, Jennifer Roberts pulled in 41,749 votes for the win. Kenny Smith got more votes than her by 8,000. He got 11,000 more votes than Edwin Peacock, and he still got just walloped in this race. So clearly, either Democrats are more motivated, unaffiliateds are jumping into the race, and finally, you know, they saw that, yes, all elections, municipal included, have consequences.
He also spent a lot of money, let's face it.
Oh, huge.
Kenny Smith outspent her incredibly, and he was on the TV with ads. I think that's why a lot of also her supporters got a little worried because they saw him out here making the charges on these ads, and there was no response from her because, of course, she didn't come until later. But so much of her campaigning was, you know, get out the vote. You had Black Political Caucus and others, and so it was a different kind of campaigning, and obviously it worked.
So that was my next question, because this is the most expensive mayoral race in Charlotte history, and we talked about this on Wednesday, you and I, Tom, and David Borax, when we were doing a postmortem on the election. The money didn't seem to didn't play a role.
Didn't play a role.
But I mean, look at the numbers. Look at the totals. She won 58-42% over him after he spent a fortune on ads, and she spent minuscule amount of money in comparison. Does that mean the advertising doesn't work anymore because everybody slams everybody else and nobody pays attention? Or does it mean something else was going on?
I think it's a combination. I believe in looking at trends as opposed to individual elections, because individual elections could easily just be outliers. But if you think about it this way, political ads are so ubiquitous now that a lot of people may just see them as white noise. And it's also hitting at a time when people are actually getting used to on-demand services where they don't have to watch political ads. I am one of these folks. I mean, honestly, during elections, I watch broadcast TV because I need to stay up on the ads that are out there. Otherwise, you know, my family and I just tend to stream or do on-demand stuff. I do think that's part of it. And I also think we saw this in 2016. I mean, you know, Hillary Clinton, Democratic candidate for president, significantly outspent in, and I'm just talking, you know, nationally too, but in North Carolina, she dominated the airwaves with ads during the presidential race. I mean, Donald Trump barely had any kind of a blip here, and he still won the race. So I think what campaigns are doing, I think what Vi Lyles did, because we also forget to mention that she, you know, she raised $422,000 in this campaign. That is a lot of money.
Yeah.
It was more focused on the call banks, the door knocking, the mailers, the classic stuff. Kenny Smith did that as well. So it's not like the Republicans were outmaneuvered on this.
That's the way it used to be years ago. People would knock on doors and you'd have supporters saying, well, come vote for my candidate. And then the TV ads took over. And now are we going back to the future here?
Well, we're a pendulum society. We tend to do that because eventually there becomes a saturation point where people learn to block things out. So it starts to swing back the other way.
She also ran a positive campaign.
Yeah. Yep,
what role did that play?
I talked to Dr. Susan Roberts actually about this on Wednesday at Davidson College, and she mentioned how one, Vi kept it very positive, which is something people like. People like to see hopeful and positivity. And even though Kenny Smith didn't run any negative ads per se from his campaign, the NC Values Coalition, which was clearly endorsing him, they ran the really negative ads with like the grainy photo and the feeling of guilt. And she's, you know, Mayor Jennifer Roberts reincarnated. And again, even though that wasn't Kenny saying, I endorse this message, it essentially was associated with Kenny. And Dr. Roberts also made, I think, an interesting point is that Vi had to go through a very hotly contested primary. Kenny Smith did not.
Yeah.
Vi Lyles had to rise up above three, you know, Democrats who were all very well known. She beat the incumbent by, again, this huge margin. So Vi Lyles had name recognition coming out of the primary that Kenny Smith didn't really have. People knew Kenny Smith was running, but he spent $2 in the primary. He was like, hey, here's a flyer. I'm here. You know, but again, he brought out his $300,000+ in the general. So that could be something, too.
Mary alluded to this earlier, but because Democrats had victories, big victories, in Virginia and in New Jersey in the governor's races there, and even in Gastonia, where a Democrat unseated a Republican incumbent mayor, the national news media made those victories the focus of the story, and Vi Lyles' picture was in the opening of the CBS Evening News on Wednesday evening, and she was a guest on MSNBC. Quickly corrected the Ari, I think, what's his last
name? Ari Melber.
He quickly corrected the pronunciation of her name. He said, here's V. Lyle, Vi, and he immediately launched into the question, so somebody talked into his ear. But there and elsewhere, she shared on MSNBC and elsewhere, she shared why she felt that she won, and part of it, she said, had to do with her being the city's first African-American woman to be mayor, and she said that was she was okay with that.
I want to be able to use the mayor's office, not because I'm a black woman, but just because of the change and the national perspective to say, come to Charlotte, look at who we are, and know what we're trying to focus on, economic opportunity for the people that live here. So that's my goal. In some ways, if you were a marketing exec, you might say this is a great thing to market. And if that is going to result in changes in our city, then I'm okay with it.
So when we come back, we have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the fact that we have the head of the county commission, the head of the school board, and the mayor of Charlotte, all African-American women, and what that may mean. We're going to come right back with our roundtable of reporters, Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Ann Doss Helms from The Observer, Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News, Charlotte, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call and WCCB. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NC Warren presenting Clean Path 2025, a strategy to slow climate change, save money, and create jobs with local solar power and battery storage. ncwarren.org. And Our Health and its network of My Clinics, providing employers of all sizes access to primary care with the goal to reduce health care costs and a commitment to help improve employee health and wellness. OURHealth.org. Wrestler Ric Flair, one of Charlotte's most famous characters, although he lives in Atlanta now, longtime Charlottines still claim him as one of their own. His heyday as a WWE wrestler in the 1980s and 90s and the behind-the-scenes glamour life that he led is part of a new 30 for 30 documentary on ESPN by another Charlottine, Rory Karpf. Guest host Eric Spanberg will be here Monday. He's joined by documentary maker Rory Karpf to talk about Ric Flair, the Nature Boy. Monday at 9.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, Democrats rack up big wins. Trump in Asia. TSA gets an F at U.S. airports. Texas church massacre. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues at 10 with On Point, following the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's the local news roundup edition of Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Tom Bullock and Doss Helms, Mary C. Curtis, and Kirsten Garris all gathered around our round table, which is not, in fact, round. Mm-hmm. If you're watching on Facebook Live, it looks like...
It's amoeba-shaped.
Amoeba. It looks like an amoeba, and it changes shape constantly through the show, which is it's troublesome. Let's talk about the fact that with Vi Lyles becoming the first African-American woman to be mayor of Charlotte, she joins the ranks of Ella Scarborough, who is an African-American woman who's at the head of the county commission, and Mary McCrae, who's an African-American woman at the head of the school board. Is this just serendipity? What's going on here?
Well, I think one of the underreported stories locally and nationally, it's the power and the strength of African-American women voters. They vote above their demographic or at the highest point for the demographic than any other group. You could arguably say that because of Michelle Obama a little bit, that they put Barack Obama in the White House.
So if Michelle ran, she'd win?
Well, that's what my husband would hope. But anyway, there's a lot of power there. They're very well educated as a group, entrepreneurs, and I think people are recognizing that. There was, I think, an Observer story, someone said, I like her because she is not a politician. She's about doing the work. And there was some criticism, her image was too boring. But a lot of people liked that hardworking nose to the grindstone.
Particularly after the last 2 years, perhaps.
Well, I guess.
That's not a criticism. It's just the fact of life.
Yeah, but I think you'll see more and more of this. A group of African-American female legislators and leaders actually wrote a letter earlier to the Democratic National Committee and others saying, wait, we are here doing the work. You need to recognize that. And I think people are waking up
to
that.
How big a factor is gender and color versus the fact that this woman, Vi Lyles, has 30-plus years' experience working in city government for the city of Charlotte, and she was, I think, was she assistant city manager?
Yes, and a budget director. Well, I think Kenny Smith's mistake, he thought he was going to run against Jennifer Roberts, mm-hmm. and he used that same campaign. And a lot of the supportive ads said, Vi Lyles is Jennifer Roberts. Well, people in Charlotte knew that wasn't true because she had that track record
right.
of budget director, of assistant city manager.
And she kept saying during these debates, in the debate that we did here at Spirit Square, she kept saying that the time for talk is over. The time now is to do something. It's the time for action.
Yes.
And people want to stop talking.
On affordable housing, on public safety, on jobs, which she talked about quite a bit. So, as I said, she was this known quantity in Charlotte.
Having a track record does matter because everybody says that. Everybody says it's time for action.
Yeah.
But she could say, I've done this action.
I've balanced budgets.
I'm not going to spend the first 6 months figuring out how city government actually works.
Yeah, but there is something to be said about seeing yourself in city government, and I think that's what a lot of people got from Vi Lyles, is that they are seeing themselves represented at the highest office, at least in city government here, especially after the year we had where African Americans were very vocal about things they didn't like in this community after the Keith Scott shooting. So it's like we do want change, and this change may be coming, and again, someone who represents that community.
And I want to say, too, that it's a great point to bring up because we also saw that in other elections that weren't just the mayor. You see that on a body which arguably has the real power in Charlotte with the city council. You see a wide, a bunch of different diversity points, and it's not simply about race. You're talking age differences, experience differences, very different views from even people in the same party. And you really start to see that, I think that's why this election overall is really about change. I mean, you could argue Vi Lyles has always been a change candidate. This was a change election. When a sitting mayor loses a partisan primary, it's about change. It was about change of approach, not change of issues. Kenny Smith was hoping it was going to be about change of issues. He lost. So her approach, Vi Lyles' approach, to be clear too, yes, absolutely. The historic moment of electing our first African-American female mayor, it's amazing. But it wasn't just about that. Her message resonated with others. And that's an important point to bring up, because you don't get 71,000 votes in a municipal election without broad support.
And Charlotte, the whole country has been going through a year now of great political turmoil for obvious reasons. And the city went through it too, with nothing to do with the president of the United States. It had all to do with HB2 and the riots that followed the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott by CMPD. And perhaps this is people to say, we want to get serious and calm down and just do the damn work. Even Kenny Smith, in his gracious,
concession speech.
Thank you. Said we can trust her, by Lyles, to drive the car. I would say you can trust her with the keys to the car and the house, too, because she's been there and she's done it. So does she have, because of her background, more clout than the average mayor, new mayor, would have coming into the job?
I don't think clout's the right word, personally. More experience.
Trust?
I think the trust is there. Sure, she's somebody who has been elected citywide in the past, and that certainly helped with this particular race. I think the bigger issue goes back to what you brought up, Mike. If you're a candidate who is, you know, campaigning on action now, you really need a deep bench of knowledge to be able to start moving on that.
Yeah.
She has that bench. The question now is if she can get everybody on the city council on the same page with some tricky issues to start doing what she said she was
going
to
do. Again, she is not an outsider to city council. And as you mentioned, that arguably the council is the most powerful body. She does have relationships with them. It doesn't always mean it's going to be the good relationship, but I think she has pretty solid relationships on both sides of the aisle.
We do have a lot of outsiders coming into city council because the makeup of city council changed. 5 new people. The ratio to Democrats and Republicans is the same, 9 Democrats to 2 Republicans, but we have 5 new members and they're all under 40. What impact is that likely to have?
I mean, it's going to change how people, again, the approach. The issues are still the same, but how they approach them will be very different. It'll be interesting to see how Braxton Winston, the protester turned politician, handles, you know, the police discussions. It talks about, you know, funding for CMPD or police community relations. His take will be different from maybe Ed Driggs, but at the same time, you have someone.
I think it's
like,
fair to say it's going to be very different than Ed Driggs.
But I think that's good that you have someone who has been literally on the police line of a protest who now can say, well, this is my perspective. And he's going to be talking directly to, you know, the CMPD's chief, Kurt Putney. Then you also have people like Dimple Ejemyr is a new face, but kind of has more. She's like the new kid on the block with the
new-ish.
Most experience. Yeah, new-ish kid on the block here. But she has a little bit more experience. But then you also have Justin Harlow for District 2. I mean, a lot of new faces could be bringing new voices to historic districts. Like, again, East Side and West Side have new voices representing their areas now.
Julie Eisel was the top vote getter in the at-large race. Traditionally, the top vote getter becomes the mayor pro tem. That has not always been the case. There was a struggle with that a couple of years ago, and somebody else won out against it. She turned down, as you pointed out on Wednesday, Tom, she turned down the opportunity because she was the top vote getter last time to do this 2 years ago because she felt that she didn't have the experience. Clearly now she probably does after 2 years, and you say that she's likely to accept that responsibility. I'm just curious what exactly the mayor pro tem does.
They act as the mayor when the mayor can't act as the mayor for whatever reason. So if the mayor is out doing something else, they run meetings, they set agendas. She would be the de facto mayor if and when Vi Lyles is
incapacitated or out of town.
Well, let's not go to incapacitated. Let's say that she has a prior commitment, and there's two things that need to happen at the same time.
She's the first runner up.
She's like the VP there.
Well, but you've seen Julie Eisel and Vi Lyles basically say, "I'm open to these new voices."
Absolutely,
because it's a sign that Charlotte wants change. As you were saying earlier, Anne, it's basically saying, "Let's do something." I believe last year when Mayor Roberts, after the protest, said, "This isn't the Charlotte I know." That was dissonant because folks felt, "Well, this is Charlotte. It just means you may not know it." So now they want some folks in that room who have been on all sides of it to bring their perspectives, and maybe something will get done.
Braxton Winston is certainly one of those people. He's 34 years old. He's a Davidson grad. He emerged as a leader because of his participation in the unrest following the Keith Scott shooting. He's a fierce critic of CMPD, and he is now the second highest vote getter on the city council in this last election. How might his presence change either how CMPD operates or citizen confidence in the police going forward and the city council's eye on the police going forward?
Wait to see. I mean, tune in. You know, in all fairness, we don't know yet. This is one of the big storylines that everyone will be following after the new council is sworn in on December 4th. And it's not just Braxton Winston. You know, you have Matt Newton, who's been an outspoken critic of CMPD. In terms of police trust, that is a long road to hoe. It is not as simple as electing a single individual. The distrust and the questions and the problems are long and they are legion, and an election will not simply solve them. These are big issues that all of Charlotte needs to think about. I'm very curious to see how that plays out. I think you will start seeing it possibly with something that's a little bit easier for the city council to think about or to start addressing with, say, the Citizens Review Board, possible changes. Their hands are tied still by certain state laws, but there are things that the council can do to change that body, to increase qualifications or experience or transparency. But in fairness to such a big issue, the real answer is wait and see.
Yeah. And I think that this may bring some balance as part of the board. There will be friction, I think. Anytime there is change in style and change in personalities, there's going to be some friction. But I do think there's a sense in the community that all of the bodies that oversee the police, whether that's the city council or the Citizens Review Board or the media or sort of mainstream society, have not given perhaps the level of scrutiny that they should. So having some people on there who are maybe going to pull that body a little more toward ask the tough questions. Of course, you don't want to see them default to automatic distrust any more than you want to see automatic trust of the police. But I think there will be that tension may be a very constructive force.
But the other thing that could happen is, you know, sometimes you rail against the machine and then suddenly you are part of the machine and you see behind the curtain and you see why certain decisions may have been made in the past and are being made going forward. And maybe you temper your opinion a little bit because you understand the why behind things. We'll see if that happens. Maybe it won't.
Yeah, well, there will be a learning curve for Braxton Winston. But in just to start, I think folks who have mistrusted the process will feel that there is a more authentic voice for them in to use up my Hamilton reference, in the room where it happens. And so at least they'll start off mainly just saying, okay, let's see what Braxton has to say. It'll put a bit of pressure on him, of course.
He's not going to give up his shot.
And I will say this. I talked with Braxton Winston yesterday, and one of his really good sound bites was he wants people to hold him accountable. You know, yes, I've made it, but still hold me accountable. Make sure I am doing what you guys voted me to do.
History has its eyes on him.
Which I actually also think, you know, one of the little things that happened with the current mayor and current city council, obviously they will remain as such until December 4th, which I thought was very disturbing, and I guarantee you will not happen with this new council. I may regret those words, but when they stopped televising public comment, that to me is inexcusable. It is absolutely ridiculous. These are your elected representatives. They're supposed to stand and listen to what you have to say and televise those things for people who can't actually make it down to the room. It's not always the most convenient thing. I seriously doubt a move like that would have ever been considered with the members of the new council.
So, as Vi Lyles made a national appearance on the national stage because of her win, evidently so did Braxton Winston, unbeknownst to him. As we all know, most of us know, Twitter has expanded its vocabulary from 140 to 280 characters for certain people, including the president, but also Chelsea Clinton, and she used her first 280 character tweet to talk about Braxton Winston. How about that? The tweet said, "Mr. President, Braxton Winston is a superb example of an actual very fine person. And yes, I know he won an election in Charlotte, not Charlottesville. Still, please learn more about him, Donald Trump." And there are other hashtags there at the end I'm not going to read. How about that?
Well, you know,
she even know about him.
The Democratic Party has been criticized for not having a deep bench of young leaders ready to step up on the scene. So they're looking around.
But seriously, how did she know about him?
Well, somebody had tweeted the photo of him from the protest that has become kind of iconic.
And
it is an attention-getting photo. She probably looked at that and researched and learned a little bit more about him and said, okay, this is a way to make a point, sort of in contrast to the president's remarks in the wake of Charlottesville about there were some very fine people at the protest, and in that case he was referring to the white nationalists and the it's pretty overt racist in some cases.
Well, in addition to the five new members of the Charlotte City Council, we have some new members of the school board, and despite opposition from town councils and chambers of commerce in the northern part of the county, the school bonds passed overwhelmingly, 73% approval for nearly $1 billion. New CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox said that he felt gratified that the vote went that way because it shows confidence in CMS, and he also said that he hopes to move quickly on the projects funded by the bonds.
What you're going to see is us begin the engineering efforts almost right away. And so we hope that within 2 years you'll be seeing the proceeds of this bond come up and out of the ground for our kids.
Okay, now I had real trouble understanding the last part of that sentence. So you translated it for me earlier this morning. And what did he just say?
I think he said that it's going to be coming up out of the ground for the kids. This was not the most coherent soundbite I've ever heard.
You're so kind.
But I would say what I had the vision of, as I was sitting there, you know, typing in these results Tuesday night, I had this vision of Clayton Wilcox going home and telling his wife, okay, unpack the boxes. We can settle it.
Yeah.
Because what this, as opposed to a message of change for the city, I think CMS got a message of stability, of political capital to move forward. I mean, this 73% is not the highest percentage they've ever gotten for bonds, but I think they hit 74% 4 years ago with this relatively small bond, but the number of yes votes was hugely higher. We're talking more than 105,000 people who said yes to school bonds.
Including people in the north.
Yes. Had the bond vote won but by a squeaker, it would have been a different message. Had it been, you know, an across-the-board no in the north, which it was not. There were only like four precincts, I think, that went no in the north. This was, for the bonds, it was a very strong yes. And for the school board, had you gotten some really unpredictable members, Clayton Wilcox might have been going, I got to sound out, you know, who I'm working with now.
Yeah.
The three incumbents got reelected. The three challengers were all the ones who were designated by the departing board members and who will come in with a very similar philosophy. They are not young. You know, this is not going to be a young board. It's a very experienced. Even the newcomers who are political newcomers know a lot about
CMS. So that's why you said the message sent by this election, the bond election, the school board elections, was stay the course, because the incumbents got elected and the heirs apparent,
yes,
the chosen heirs got elected. If this bond issue indicates confidence in CMS, why did growth in student enrollment, why was it so slow? It was flat. Why? If people are leaving the school system, why are they confident, therefore, with the bonds?
And that is an interesting question. I do think that people see school bonds as something that benefits not just their child necessarily. And this was very much the case that the Vote Yes campaign made and that the school district was making, was that this is about building your community. This is about building the future. This is, you know, maybe your school isn't even getting what you hope it would get, but we've got to work for the whole community. So that is a... There seems to be some capital to move forward. It's not totally clear what forward will mean. I think that's something that the new board and Clayton Wilcox have to figure out.
You got 10 seconds.
You're also assuming that those people who aren't big fans of CMS voted for this. Doesn't mean that they necessarily did.
That's why you're on this panel. That's Tom Bullock from WFAE News. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Southern Christmas Show, now through November 19th at the Park Expo and Conference Center, celebrating their silver and gold 50th anniversary with an entrance that looks down memory lane. Tickets at southernchristmasshow.com. And Wildology, barred owls are determining their territory. November is the time to install barred owl boxes so these raptors can be enjoyed in the backyard. Located in Waverly, next to Whole Foods, GoWildology.com. Democrats score their first victories of the Trump era. The investigation continues into the Texas church shooting, sex allegations against the Republican Senate candidate in Alabama, and comedian Louis C.K. is the latest celebrity to face allegations of sexual misconduct. Those are just some of the stories they'll be talking about as the news roundup continues during On Point in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, and ours continues as well in about 30 seconds. Stay with us.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Brazil has a new homicide count for 2016, and it's the highest in the country's recorded history.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
State Health Department officials wouldn't say how much the expanded program will cost, but it will likely be a lot. Last year, the state spent $72.6 million.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup, which explains the presence of all these media people. Kirsten Garris is here from Spectrum News, where she's a government reporter. Mary C. Curtis, columnist at Roll Call and contributor to WCCB News Rising, among other entities. Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Tom Bullock with us from WFAE News. So you wrote an article, which appeared in the paper yesterday, Ann, about some surprising facts with regard to the makeup of the new school board, starting with the fact that Republican Sean Strain will be the only man on the school board. Where are all the men?
You know, there were not a lot of candidates. The current board is 6 women and 3 men. All 3 men said, we're not running again. They actually could not have elected a woman in District 6. It was the only race that had only men in the race, so voters apparently liked, at least if not women in general, the women that were running for these races. But it appears to be kind of a fluke. This is not the national trend. It's fairly evenly divided nationally. I looked at Wake and Guilford. They're both 5 women, 4 men. So,
another key question you raised. Where are all the young people? Because unlike city council, where we have 5 new members under 40, you reported that this school board will have no one under 50. And three
but
of
no
the,
one under 40.
Under 40. And
three under 50.
Under 50.
Yeah.
Why?
Again, you know, not really clear. There were some young people who ran. I wonder if, you know, the young people who won on the city did not just raise their hands and say, I want to be on the city council. They ran really well-organized campaigns, and they also had, in some cases, I think, partisan organizations to help them figure out how to run a campaign. And I wonder if the nonpartisan nature of the school boards, the younger candidates had to compete against some pretty well-established voices. The people who won were people who, and the school board races are almost never big money races with the exception of District 5, but you had people who really had a network, who were in their 40s or 50s, and the young people were not able to make a serious dent against them.
You also asked, where are all the educators? Because there are no people with there are very few people with educational in the classroom or school experience on the school board now.
Right. And current CMS.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, you could argue a lot about that. Mary McCray, who is one of the 2 retired teachers on the board, said, you know, it would be great if we had more, but bear in mind that if you are currently a teacher or a principal or any kind of CMS employee and you run for the school board, you have to be willing to resign if you actually win the race. So that's a pretty big impediment right there. But there are retirees. There are all sorts of former. But she said, you know what? Look at the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Association of Educators. They had a perfect record. They endorsed the 6 candidates who won. So the educators are still in there and still going to have a voice.
So you reported about something else with regard to the schools this week. That's nothing to do with the election, and it kind of took my breath away. You report that CMS's youngest students, age 5 to 7, are being suspended at much lower rates this year. First, why are they suspending little kids? And secondly, why is the rate down this year?
Well, because this has been a topic of really hot debate for a couple of years now, and I think everybody is shocked anew when you hear about suspending this. The report didn't include, well, even pre-kindergartners, although they were not part of this report. But yes, kindergartners, first graders, second graders, and there were members of the board. Erica Ellis Stewart was very vocal about this, who were saying this should not be acceptable. There should be a moratorium. Obviously, if they act out, they need to have some kind of consequence, but it doesn't need to be suspension from school. And educators and board members said there are some cases where this needs to be the case. There were 3 young children who brought knives to school and were suspended because of that. But most of the suspensions were for these categories called aggressive behavior and disruptive behavior. And then that becomes the question of, this is a judgment call. And so many of the young children who are being suspended are, in fact, Black male young children.
That's exactly what I was
saying. So you get into this perpetual debate about, you know, you have one group that says, well, clearly those kids are just kind of bad kids. They're doing a lot of bad stuff. And then you have another group that says, yeah, really?
Who's making the decision on those suspensions? Is it a bunch of old white people?
Well, it's principals, and certainly some of them are people of color and are males of color. But now that sign-off, if it's younger than 3rd grade, has to come from the superintendent, and they've just added that layer of review.
Yes, I was going to, you know, to add on to what Anne was saying, that studies throughout the country have shown that the suspension rates are primarily black children, particularly black males, but also black females. They're suspended
at the higher grades, too.
Yeah, but even into kindergarten and preschool. Okay. And so many of it is it's a judgment call. When you see the same behavior from a young white child and a young black child, are you judging it more aggressive if it's an African American? And all the studies have shown that. And then also in so many of the schools, you have these resource officers and these police officers in schools, which is something that was not when I was in grade schools. So are teachers and principals and others abdicating their role being leaders and principals and advisors by just automatically saying that this is an issue of just a bad kid doing something terrible and there has to be some kind of repercussions? And when it starts like this, does it extend into that what they call the school-to-prison pipeline?
That's what concerns
if you
me.
Start out basically telling these kids they're bad, suspending them, punishing them, expelling them, will that extend into the, you know, the middle grades, the high school grades, where they pretty much give up on learning and give up on school? And all the studies have shown
well, if you keep being punished when you go to school, school becomes a very unpleasant place to be.
You're also
yes.
You're also told this is who you are.
Yeah.
If you're taught that from an early age, it can stick. And if you're basically being told that you are destined to be a bad kid that turns into a criminal, you can, you know, society can inadvertently be pushing people straight down that path and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. That's what's always worrying.
Yeah, and as the mother of a white son who was bright and talkative and sometimes broke the rules and, you know, occasionally made a mistake that could have gotten him labeled as bad kid, suspend him, and he never got labeled that. He was always embraced as the bright young child with potential who occasionally messes up. Mm-hmm. I would certainly want that for everybody else's child too.
If you're constantly asking questions in the class and bugging the teacher, when is it judged that you're obnoxious and disruptive, and when that you're inquisitive, questioning? Maybe we need to put him in an advanced class.
Yeah.
And it's particularly when the teachers often do not reflect the students, and it's not reflecting what they have at home. And I'm the mother of a black son, and I had to be an advocate in there for him all the time.
We actually have about 2,800 educators of gifted kids from around the country here in Charlotte for a convention, and one of the things they're talking about is why so few low-income students, students of color, are in those gifted classes.
Oh, yeah.
So that's that whole loop we're talking about.
All right, let's move on because I've got a lot of ground to cover here in a very short amount of time, and I want to go to the outlying areas and finish up the election results in those areas. We have a new mayor in Gastonia. They elected their third black mayor, Walker Reed, unseated incumbent John Bridgman. Why?
You got more votes?
Yeah. Same could be said, you know, looking for a change. And he was actually the first, I guess, elected African-American mayor in Gastonia versus the others who were appointed. So that is also a point to make out there.
Well, he said he had a very good strategy and he stuck to it. Davidson is another place where the incumbent mayor was unseated. Real estate agent, musician Rusty Knox, the son of a previous Davidson mayor, beat incumbent John Woods. This was based, I take it, on concerns about growth.
Save Davidson. That's really the power player here.
Yeah, and it's which is fascinating because there's, you know, this was all about whether or not Davidson is going to continue to explode with population growth and new development or not. Knox is in the not camp.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But in that, just real quick on that too, the local races were really where the nail biters were. And you've got in Davidson a chance for a recount from one of the seats on the city council because two people were separated by I'm just looking here again to try to remember. It's just a few votes. I can't even remember how many it was, but easily we could see a recount next Friday.
Okay. In Concord, Mayor Scott Padgett decided to retire after 16 years. Bill Dush won a five-way race with 40% of the vote. Who is he and why was the margin of victory so wide in a five-way race? He must be really popular. What did he say? Nobody knows.
Okay.
The right
he
thing.
Said, thank you. I'd like to thank all of my supporters, those
right.
who believed in the campaign.
Let's get to work.
Got the most votes.
Perhaps we should not talk about the outlying area.
No, we can talk about that was one I could not do.
In Matthews, Jim Taylor decided to retire as mayor. He was replaced by current CMS school board member Paul Bailey, who was Taylor's pick. Aside from that, any particular reason he beat Larry Whiteley, 57.5 to 41.7%?
He's a Republican.
Yeah. Yes.
And the winner, remember, he had had that post, I think, was it on Facebook or in social media, the eventual winner, that was judged as being racially insensitive, and he apologized, and it didn't seem to hurt him.
Okay. In Cornelius, Huntersville, and Mint Hill, the winners, Woody Washam, John Anarala, and Ted Biggers, were all unopposed. Is that unusual to have no opposition in a mayoral campaign?
I don't think in a suburban race. I mean, Huntersville had a really kind of knockdown, drag-out fight 2 years ago. There's lots of questions about whether former mayor Jill Swain was going to jump back into the race. She, of course, did not. But again, I can't help but point out, in Cornelius and Huntersville, we have two other places on the town board or commission that are potential for recounts.
So it seems like an odd time for former Governor Pat McCrory to be talking about his loss of the governor's mansion last year to Roy Cooper, but he did. He told David Chadwick, who hosts a religious radio show on WBT, that President Trump cost him votes.
I lost some of the Trump votes because I was going around saying at the Trump rallies, there's a Carolina comeback. We're coming back. The economy's booming. Then Donald Trump would come out. Things are going to heck in a handbag. The economy's terrible. And we were given mixed messages. So 1 or 2% of those voters going, what's that guy saying? You know, right. I'm going with Trump.
Disconnect.
So I'm going to vote for Trump, but I'm going to vote for the Libertarian.
Wow.
And when you lose a close election, everyone thinks about the toll lanes or HB2 or whatever. There were other. It was really a death of a thousand cuts. Yeah.
Is this the first time he's blamed the president for his loss? Because the blame keeps shifting here.
Well, I got to say, I listened to the whole 38 minutes last night, and if I'd had a dollar for every time he blamed the media for something, it would have been a very profitable evening. So it's a pattern that we've seen from Pat McCrory before. There's always somebody else that cost him this or that. He was
the Hillary Clinton playbook.
He actually said specifically that there was a reference to that, and he said, "Oh, don't let me be like Hillary, you know, don't let me." But and then he came back and, you know, talked about all the reasons that he lost because somebody else did something. But he was actually very complimentary of Trump. He referred to the president as being extremely charming and pleasant. He noted that he used to call Pat McCrory up during the campaign, and McCrory said he had actually just met with Trump 2 weeks ago in Greensboro. So
he's still looking for that job in the Trump administration.
And he did, of course, toss out the possibility that he might run for governor.
And in that conversation with David Chadwick, he also spoke about something that he shared with me a long time ago, back in the day when he used to appear on this program, that public reaction to him had become vicious.
We got physical threats. Here in Charlotte, I'd go to events and people would do the You McCrory and you know, you blankety blank blank blank,
and
we'd be in a restaurant.
You'd be walking down the street in a restaurant, and someone just come
yeah.
Up
it was
to
worse
you.
Here in Charlotte, really? Probably here in Asheville, Charlotte, and a little bit in downtown Raleigh, and the college campuses were the worst. I mean, it's so my wife wouldn't walk with me.
Hmm. He went on to say that his wife had basically moved out of Charlotte because of the encounters that she and he have faced as a result of this last election. But he did open the door for a future run, because he says she's not thrilled at my possible return to politics. What might he be interested in running for?
It isn't governor. I mean, if it is governor, I'm going to tell you he's going to have a tough primary fight, because it's pretty clear that Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, a very conservative Republican, has his eyes set on going up against Governor Roy Cooper in the next election. And to be clear, in the last election, Dan Forrest received more votes than Pat McCrory. Good luck with that, Pat. I've got to say, I don't think Dan Forrest is going to wait for you.
The latest mass shooting in America was last Sunday. It occurred at a church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, where just about everybody knew everybody else. 5 years ago, that would have been inconceivable. We would not be able to function today. We'd be still so much in shock. Today, not so much. This has resulted in some Charlotte churches examining their own security protocols.
Just the notion that someone can come in at any time and spray the sanctuary with bullets is just mortifying. But at the same time, you don't want to get to the place where you got to put metal detectors in the church.
That's Dwayne Walker, who's the pastor of Charlotte's Little Rock AME Zion Church, who also said the 1,000-member congregation was already in the process of installing surveillance cameras and posting uniformed guards. Tom, you reported on this, WFAE reported on this. Are other churches taking similar precautions?
Yes, or they're at least bare minimum considering it. And it's a sad thing to think that a house of worship is the type of place now that has to worry about security. But that is where we're at.
In the aftermath of the incidents in New York with a terrorist mowing down pedestrians and bicyclists with a rented truck, President Trump immediately called for the death penalty for that perpetrator. Following both the Las Vegas mass shooting and the shooting on Sunday in Texas, he said now was not the time to talk about guns. And following the Texas shooting, he laid the blame on mental illness. And in talking about terrorism in general, the president has called for extreme vetting of immigrants. But following the Texas shooting, he said, even with tighter vetting of gun buyers, there would have been no difference. What are we to make of these mixed messages?
I'm going to actually zero in on one point here that I can't just let slip. One of the first things that President Donald Trump did, this was in February, was quietly sign a bill that removed some Obama-era regulations about people with known mental illness being able to purchase firearms. And basically what that law did was the rules that were in place would basically say that if you're collecting Social Security because you've been deemed so mentally ill that it's a disability, or you have been found that you are not financially reliable enough to be in control of your own finances, that you wouldn't be able to carry a firearm. 75,000 people would have been added to a list that says you can't buy guns. If Donald Trump believes that this is something that needs to be fixed on a mental health side, not a firearm side, I would hope that he is at least looking at that action.
John Bullock from WFAE News, Andos Helms from The Observer, Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News, Charlotte, and Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call on WCCB. We end with some numbers. Billy Graham is 99. Happy birthday, Billy Graham. And the Panthers are 6-3. They play Monday. That's it. We're done.